Our next guest I've heard speak several times and listened to his videos. Very stimulating, very thought-provoking conversation. And he's a constitutional expert. His ideas, his concepts, I think, are so needed today. He's written several books. His new book is called An Introduction to Constitutional Law. Isn't that what we kind of need in America? A reintroduction or an introduction? 100 Supreme Court cases everyone should know. He is a the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at Georgetown University Law Center. He teaches constitutional law and contracts, is the director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. Who else do you want to talk to about the Constitution? Randy Barnett, thank you so much for coming to the show today.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for having me on. You'll notice the name of my center is Georgetown Center for the Constitution. We are for the Constitution at the Georgetown Center.
Well, very good. Well, let me start there. I was going to start somewhere else, but since you brought that up, we have the perception, when I say we, most of the listeners of our show, that colleges have been kind of taken over by this progressive new interpretation of America. But you're sitting there real stalwart at Georgetown. Kind of give us your perspective on what the attitude towards the Constitution at colleges is.
Well, I think most people, when they come to college and they come to law school, generally like the Constitution. It's part of the American creed to like our Constitution. And it's only when they get to school are they then educated about why they might not like the Constitution so much. Georgetown is really no different than any other. I would say generally, before I get there, law schools have been slower to adopt this sort of anti-America, anti-constitutional approach that you see in the humanities departments in undergraduates, but it's coming to us. We're getting it as well. The left is arriving, and we're having deplatforming and things like that starting to happen in law schools. Georgetown is a predominantly left-of-center law school. Most of my colleagues are what you might call liberals as opposed to leftists in their sensibilities, meaning they still believe in free speech. They still believe in the free interchange of ideas. And they're generally favorable about the Constitution as an ideal. So I don't really have a big problem with my colleagues. They don't have a big problem with me. On the other hand, my center, the Center for the Constitution, is devoted to originalism, which is the idea that we interpret the Constitution according to the meaning it had at the time it was enacted. And that is a very, very small minority view now amongst law professors generally, including at Georgetown. But I do have a center there, which means our view is represented, and the students who are interested in that idea have access to that idea from our center.
Why is originalism, which is the idea that our founders, when they put it into place, they put our law into place, what was their attitude, what was their meaning? I guess that's a good way to describe that. Why is originalism so on the outs? I mean, that just seems to make sense to me.
Well, originalism can be defined in one sentence. I'll give you a good sentence for this, and that is that the meaning of the Constitution should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment. That's originalism.
I like
the
that.
The meaning of the Constitution should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment, which means judges can't change it, the Congress can't change it, state legislatures can't change it, the president can't change it. Why is that? That's because the Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us. The Constitution does not govern us, we the people. The Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us. And those who are to govern us should no more be able to change the law that governs them without going through the amendment process than we can change the laws they make and impose on us without going through the legislative process. We can't change the speed limits to what speed limits we like better without going through the speed limit change process, which is probably harder than amending the Constitution. and neither can they. So originalism is very, very commonsensical. It's what everybody's default position is. Not only that, it's even what sophisticated people's default position is when they're playing sort of in new territory. So as soon as you start talking about impeachment, you start hearing about what the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors was at the time of the founding. As soon as you talk about the right to keep and bear arms, you start hearing about, well, what was the right to keep and bear arms at the time of the founding? It's really everybody's default position when they don't have precedent or Supreme Court cases that they prefer to the original meaning of the text.
Let me go back. How unique, you know, obviously I'm sure that you have some perspective on world governments and history, what have you. How unique was the is the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution?
Well, the Declaration of Independence, we have to remember, is what started this country. It is our founding document. It lays out the political theory of the United States of America and justifies us in separating from another power, which was Great Britain. And then, and only then, were there two cracks of government to implement the Declaration. The first was the Articles of Confederation, and the second was the Constitution that came 13 years later. So our country didn't start with the Constitution. Our country started with the Declaration, and it lays out our political theory, which is summarized in two sentences. Our entire political theory of the United States is summarized in two sentences of the Declaration. The one everybody knows is we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And let me note that the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are individual rights. They're rights that belong to us as individuals. They're not group rights or collective rights. And then the next sentence states the political theory of the United States, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So it states the relationship between government and rights, which is that government exists to secure these rights. It states that governments are instituted among men. Governments are not us. They are instituted among men, and they derive their just powers, not all powers, not unlimited powers. They're just powers from the consent of the governed. And by consent of the governed here, we mean the people decide we're going to be ruled by this government and we're not going to be ruled by that government. This government, we the government of the United States, first under the Articles and then under the Constitution, not the government of Great Britain, the government of England. So that, or Parliament.
There was a, I don't know, a few years ago started, maybe 10 years ago now, I don't know. You see those silicone bracelets that people put on, they put on, you know, for cancer research or whatever, but one of the ones that really popular was WWJD. What would Jesus do? And people put that on and they had it on. Well, I like when it comes to government, for me, an American government, I like to have on WWTJD, meaning what would Thomas Jefferson do? And so I like to ask people like yourself, if this gun control debate was going on or Second Amendment debate was going on and Thomas Jefferson could speak, what would Thomas Jefferson say about some of these things?
Well, I hope you don't mind that I take issue with that. In fact, I thought you were going somewhere else with this. It's kind of a joke amongst originalists, which is that for a long time, the sort of naive version of originalism or the one that wasn't really developed, undeveloped proto-originalism was the WWJM.
James Madison. James Madison.
What would James Madison do? WWJM do?
Okay. We'll start there.
And basically that's the way originalism was done for quite a while until the 1990s, until the 1980s and 90s when Justice Scalia first and foremost started urging people, this before he was on the Supreme Court, this is when he was on the D.C. Circuit, that we should not be thinking about what the intentions of the framers or founders were. We should be instead talking about what the public meaning of the text they wrote was. That's what the meaning is. We are bound by the meaning of what they wrote. We are not bound by the intentions they had, or including the expectations they had. And we should not answer constitutional questions by positing a hypothetical James Madison and say, hey, James Madison, would you think that the thermal imaging of a house to detect increased heat from cultivating marijuana was a search? This is not a historical question. That is a counterfactual hypothetical thought experiment is what it is. So what we really ought to do is find out instead what is the original meaning of search and what was an unreasonable search? What was the word unreasonable used to connote in those days? And going back to your question about the Second Amendment, was the right to keep and bear arms? There's only really three possibilities now. There used to be two, now there are three. Was it an individual right, like the right of freedom of speech? Was it a collective right of states to have an organized militia, which is what was long claimed, at least since the 1960s, to be the meaning of the Second Amendment? Or, as that's been claimed since about 2000, is it an individual right to bear arms in an organized militia? That's what the gun controllers are claiming now. And of these three possibilities, what does the evidence support most strongly? And I think there's no doubt that the evidence supports most strongly the individual rights interpretation, which is the one that protects each and every one of our right to keep and bear arms.
Well, discuss that. I definitely want to get back to what you said before because I really like where you're going. That was very fascinating. But let's expound on this. The Second Amendment says the militia, comma, or semicolon, being necessary for a free state, semicolon, comma, the right for the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. It's almost like there's two different things. The militia is one thing, the right of the people. It's almost like it's talking to, expound on this, the original meaning, how we should look at this.
Right, right. Well, the very succinct Second Amendment was a distillation of several proposals that were coming from the states, as well as the original drafts of rights that James Madison proposed to the first Congress. And there were two concerns that were expressed. One is the importance of the general militia in order to protect liberty, which was something that people cared about. And the other was the right to keep and bear arms, which also people cared about. And what people realized at that time is that the right to keep and bear arms was a means of protecting the general militia. That is, the way that militia works is everybody has their own guns. That's almost the definition of militia. People with their own private guns. And if the federal government is going to eliminate the militia, the way they do that is by disarming the public. That's what England did. That's what the history shows the governments did. So the way to protect the general militia, and the general militia is a general militia, not a select militia like the National Guard, but a general militia, which is everybody, virtually everybody. The way you protect the general militia is by protecting an individual right of each and every person to have a gun, not to have a gun, to have a weapon, but that included firearms as well as edge weapons. So that's the way you keep the militia armed and thereby preserve it. And so the first part of the Second Amendment denotes one of the ends, and the second part, the right part, denotes the means. So it was the adoption of an individual right to keep and bear arms as a means to the end of securing a well-regulated militia.
You are this is beautiful, Randy. I mean, I'm really enjoying this. Virginia, Georgetown's pretty close to Virginia there. You saw kind of ground zero for this debate. You saw a governor who hell-bent on pushing, gun control, and then you saw a group of sheriffs get together and say, this is against the Bill of Rights. Not only will we not enforce it, we will stop you from trying to take our guns. I mean, what do you make of that confrontation? This is pretty dramatic.
Of course. I mean, one of the reasons we have gun rights that we have today in this country, not because of the Supreme Court, not because of the lower courts. For many, many years, the lower courts did nothing to protect our gun rights. We have gun rights in this country because the American people, many, many people in the United States, value their gun rights, and they vote as an issue. It's a voting issue for them. That's what the NRA, among other gun rights organizations, depends upon. The NRA is not a lobbying group that has economic power. The NRA is a group, a civil rights group, that represents millions of Americans, and there are other gun rights groups as well. They're not the only one. So that's the reason why we have the gun rights we enjoy today. The Supreme Court did finally recognize an individual right to keep and bear arms in 2006 in the Heller case, so now we do have some judicial protection. But frankly, the courts have sort of been undermining the Supreme Court in the Heller case, and that's the reason why these measures that have been proposed in Virginia. Are thought to be, people think that they'll be upheld, or, the people who advocate them believe they'll be upheld by the courts, in part because the courts have been upholding gun laws left and right over the last 10 years. We need the Supreme Court to speak again and to instruct the lower courts to take the Second Amendment right as seriously as the First Amendment right has been taken in the past. But, of course, as you know, the First Amendment is also under challenge.
How do you think it'll break down? I mean, how do you think this is going to go?
Which part? The gun rights part?
Yes, the gun question. And how do you think it? Because you want my opinion. See, there's a certain percentage of Americans. I don't care how many senators they put in front of Capitol Hill and lecture them about giving up their guns. They're not going to give up their guns. That's my opinion.
Well, there's a lot, a lot of people say that, and I believe them. I think that you never know what will happen when the crunch comes. I mean, I'm a gun owner myself, and if they came to my door with a legal, lawful order to confiscate my guns, I would not resist law enforcement because that's just me. I respect others who might feel differently about that. But
well, let me stop you there. That's a very good point. Okay, when the governor, see, this is kind of where the rubber meets the road. Not kind of, this is where the rubber meets the road. The sheriffs in Virginia are saying, the governor, you come and you pass a law in the state legislature that says that you can disarm us. That's not law. That's against the Bill of Rights. Therefore, it's null and void. So it's not law at all. So that's where the debate comes. So comment on that.
Right. Well, actually, there was a concept at the founding known as interposition, which is not, as some people think, nullification. Interposition is not the same thing as nullification. It's not that the states could nullify a federal law, but that they could interpose themselves between the federal government and the people and help protect the individual's rights. That's what these sheriffs are doing. They're interposing themselves between the people they represent, their constituents, and the state of Virginia. And they're saying, you know, we are not going to do your bidding in obeying and adhering to an unconstitutional law. We can't nullify the law. The law is the law. But we are not going to follow it, and then you can do with us what you like. But that's what we're going to do. And, you know, since sheriffs in almost every county except the urban counties in Virginia has said that, the prospects of enforcement are not very good. And I think that's part of the reason why, as I understand it, the Virginia legislature did back off on some of the more extreme measures that they were considering.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Marbury versus Madison, one of the supreme law of the land is the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. If it is against the Bill of Rights, it is null and void, correct?
Well, Marbury versus Madison is one of the 100 Supreme Court cases everyone should know.
Yes, good. That's a good segue. Getting back to your book. Go ahead.
So let me tell you about that book, because it has to do with the relationship between the Constitution and constitutional law. The main title of the book is An Introduction to Constitutional Law. So far, all we've been talking about is the Constitution. That is the document that governs those who govern us, and that we're trying to figure out what it means. But we have court systems, and the court puts that document into action. They effectuate that document in part by enforcing it against the other branches and against the states. And when they do that, they make law. They make doctrine. They make rules. Like the Heller case I mentioned, it creates a doctrine or rules that lower courts are supposed to follow. The doctrine made by the Supreme Court is not the same thing as the Constitution itself. That's point number one. To learn that doctrine is not enough just to study the Constitution. You have to study what the courts have done. And my co-author, Josh Blackman, and I have prepared. We've spent 2 years making a 63-video series of videos 5 to 15 minutes each. I think they run about 11 hours total if you watch them from beginning to end. And we explain, starting at the founding, the 100 cases that pretty much every law student must know about when they go to law school, when they take law, constitutional law, and which most people ought to know about, but which are very hard to understand because they're technical. But we make them easy to understand in these videos. And if you buy our book, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know, which is on Amazon. It's back ordered now, but you can place your order now. It keeps going out of stock. Ever since we've been on the Mark Levin Show, it's been out of stock, in and out of stock. If you buy our book, you get a written version of this course, and you get an access code that will let you access online and on your media and on your phone and other things the 63 videos that we made. If you watch these videos, you'll know exactly what Marbury versus Madison was, what it wasn't, and all the other famous cases that everybody needs to know if they want to understand constitutional law in this country.
Fantastic. We got about a minute, maybe 2 minutes before the break. The book is An Introduction to Constitutional Law, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know. RandyBarnett.com is your website, Randy, and then, of course, you can get the books on Amazon. That was a bad host. That was a bad job of me promoting your book there. Just enjoying the interview with you.
We got to it. And readers, your listeners should know that on randybarnett.com, you can access every article that I've written for free on randybarnett.com. So if you like what you're hearing, you can mine the over 100 articles that I've written about the Constitution and other subjects on randybarnett.com.
Okay, Marbury versus Madison. We got about 2 minutes or so. Anything contrary to the Bill of Rights is null and void. That's kind of what I gather from that. Your feeling, what should we take away from that part?
Marbury was the first time a Supreme Court actually invalidated federal law because it conflicted with the Constitution, and including the Bill of Rights, but it would be any part of the Constitution. But it's not the first time that the idea that judges would have to do that, it was made. It was made by Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78, and it was actually made by the Supreme Court prior to Marbury. Marbury wasn't even the most famous case involving this. It just happens to be the first time that the Supreme Court actually invalidated a federal law. They'd said before they could do it, but they hadn't done it, then they did it. So that's what Marbury versus Madison is.
Oh, geez, that was succinct. That's fantastic. We got about a minute. There's a big debate. People talk about the Declaration of Independence not being law. You know, what is it? Well, it certainly recognized truths or natural law. Was the Declaration of Independence, do you consider it as part of the Constitution to you? I know at one point in America's history, they kind of were together and then it separated. Where do you fall on that discussion?
The Declaration of Independence was a legal document that established the country. And it was voted on unanimously by the Congress of the United States, that every state that had delegates in what was then the Congress of the United States voted to approve the Declaration of Independence. So it's as official a document, officially adopted document, as any we have. It states the political philosophy of the United States. And then you have to view that as the end and the Constitution as the means to that end, like the Articles of Confederation was the means to that end, just as the preservation of a well-regulated militia is the end, and the right to keep and bear arms is the means to that end.
Wow.
And that's the relationship between the Constitution and the Declaration.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you understand the power of the description he just gave you and what that means and the ramifications. And unfortunately, in America, we've kind of lost some of these things. Just brilliant. RandyBarnett.com. Of course, his book at Amazon. An Introduction to Constitutional Law, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. We're going to get into some more stuff with Randy on the other side. This is the Power Hour. So glad you joined us.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Break the bond of Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
With dozens of food and storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Humana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high-fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Humana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made just for you. Food stores I love to eat. Yum!
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Ladies and gentlemen, of course, all the great products at thepowermall.com. Thepowermall.com. 877-817-9829. Buy from the good guys, will you? And I know there's something there you need, especially with everything that's going on. We'll keep you up to date with my uncle and I using the kidney support from Strauss and all the other great products. Have them, buy them, use them. This is a very interesting times we have with the virus and the environment and all that. So thank you for your support, your purchases, your donations, your prayers. We need them and we use them all. So thank you so much. That allows us to be able to bring you the information we do, including our guest today, who are just delighted he's here, randybarnett.com. That's with two T's, Barnett with two T's, randybarnett.com. An Introduction to Constitutional Law, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know is his new book. He's written a lot of books. I mean, as you can tell, he's very prolific, he's very measured, and he's very intelligent and provocative. So we're very excited to have him. Getting back to you, Randy, this, what troubles me is, you know, America is the Declaration of Independence to me, at least the idea. The concept, the idea of America, if it's an idea, which I think it is, that's the Declaration of Independence. Coming out of that, people still seem to have this concept of we the people, meaning this collective almost. So there's we the people, the individual, which endowed by the Creator, and the greatest good is that individual has the opportunity to then live their life and produce and private property and use some of their God-given or Creator-given talent to bring value to the property so then it becomes part of them. I mean, this is a very complicated and deep discussion, but that's basically what the founders thought, and now all of a sudden we see this collective idea, not all of a sudden, but for a long time, this collective idea come and trying to take that and eat up the individual that our founding fathers won for us. Your perspective on this debate.
Right. Well, this is something I wrote a whole book about this. My last book, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People, is all about this subject. And basically, I identify two conceptions of we the people. One that leads to, that underlies what you might call a democracy, and the other one that underlies what you would call a republic. The one that underlies the democracy, which actually was made popular by the modern Democratic Party, which was founded in the 1820s, after Jefferson, they took the view that they called themselves the democracy as well as the Democratic Party. They took the view that we the people were a group. And if we the people stand for a group of people, then obviously the way a group exercises sovereignty popular sovereignty is by majority rule, because how else is a Jew group going to govern? They have, we can't govern each and every person, right? So if popular sovereignty means rule by we the people as a group, we the people as a group means majority rule, that leads to democracy. That leads to the idea that whoever has the greatest number ought to be the one that calls the shots. The other vision of we the people is as individuals. And I already mentioned that with respect to the Declaration of Independence, that the right to life, liberty, and property were each individual rights. And then what government is, it's not that we the people rule, because we the people are the governed. We are not the rulers. What we the people do is we institute government amongst us. Amongst governments are instituted among men. And that government then is our agent, and they're supposed to protect the rights of each and every one of us. So this is what a republic is. A republic is a government that's set up to protect the pre-existing rights of each and every person, and which the government is the agents and the people are the principals. And then getting back to what we talked about in the last half hour, the only way the people can really hold the government to its powers is by establishing a constitution that the government must follow. And that's the reason why the Constitution is the law that was ratified by the people that governs those who govern us. It's not the law that governs us.
That is,
I should also say that standing behind all of this is the Declaration of Independence, which lays out this whole theory, and which was the officially adopted political theory of the United States.
Where did we, you mentioned the Democratic Party, but it seems like that idea has gained steam 60s, especially up until maybe just recently. It seems like it's starting to turn back. But that seemed to be the predominant idea in courts, even though the people maybe wanted their individuality. The courts and everything around them, the government was telling them that they didn't, and we need more power to govern you and control you. That's what it seemed like. Your thoughts on that?
That's true, but you remember, this is nonpartisan. It's not even, conservatives tend to be this way as well.
I agree.
Have this view that we the people are a group and you need majority will. And that's the reason why they are opposed to judicial review, because they say, well, unelected lifetime appointed judges should not thwart the will of we the people. And what's the will of we the people? Well, it just happens to be the will of a majority of a handful of people that are in the legislature. It's like a few hundred people. They're the ones that are supposed to speak for all of us. That's more of a democratic vision of sovereignty. That's not the Republican vision of sovereignty, in which those legislators have to be bound by the rule of law, just like we do.
There's a really famous case, Chisholm versus Georgia. I don't know if that's one of the cases that you talk about in your book.
I do. I have basically a chapter about Chisholm.
Okay. John Jay, I know one, it's a pretty famous quote where John Jay breaks down how the power de-evolved from the crown to the people themselves, that they became sovereigns without subjects. Explain, how do you break down, how do you analyze that decree?
Right. Both John Jay and James Wilson, Jay was the Chief Justice and James Wilson was the Associate Justice, both argued that basically if sovereignty means anything, and Wilson pointed out that the Constitution nowhere uses the term sovereignty. And he said if anybody was going to call themselves a sovereign, it would be the people themselves. And they refrained from the ostentatious declaration, he said. Anyway, if anybody would be the sovereign, it's the people, but it's the people as individuals. He says sovereignty must reside in those from whom the power, the rights are, and that is, in sovereignty must reside in the man, he said, meaning the person. That was what Wilson said. I should also mention, that's one of the cases we discussed in the 100 Supreme Court cases everyone should know. We have a whole video on Chisholm versus Georgia.
This point right here is, I'm really disappointed the quote-unquote Christians in this country, that they don't understand this or feel this, that they're not aggressive about this. Because of all the people in the world, they should believe in their biblical beliefs. Hey, God endowed us with dominion. We have dominion. We're individually accountable to our Creator. Then why wouldn't that just translate, well, we're individuals with dominion in law, and law should protect that relationship, and we should be able to exercise this dominion that our Creator gave us? I mean, to me, that's just America 101, but we somewhere miss this.
Well, it's been under attack for a long time. I mean, this is what the progressive movement, which started in the late 19th century, in like the 1880s, 1890s, and started to gain political traction in the 20th century, this is what they were pushing. This is what this Democrat, this democratic vision of popular sovereignty is what they were pushing. Along with the populists, they were also pushing this. They were kind of in league with each other. And it eventually got traction, and we've had 100 years of people pushing this philosophy. On the other hand, I would say the progressives tend to like majority rule when they're in the majority. When they're minority, when they're in the minority, they're not a big fan of majority rule.
So I've noticed that.
unlike populists, but progressives tend to be pretty opportunistic about when they assert the will of the majority and when they start complaining about the tyranny of the majority, which is something you really ought to complain about. But they're not really consistent about this. What they really want is power, and they're willing to justify power using anything that sounds good at the time.
I've noticed that. We're talking to Randy Barnett, who is a director of the law office there at Georgetown University, the director of Georgetown Center for the Constitution. His website is randybarnett.com. We're talking about his new book, Introduction to Constitutional Law. I've noticed that with them, that they are very aggressive. It's like they use the Bill of Rights to destroy the Bill of Rights to then gain power.
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I would say that primarily what's happened is the left uses freedom of speech to gain power, in which time they're perfectly happy to control the speech of others. I think history has shown this to be true everywhere it has happened, and it certainly is happening in the United States, where the left were the big proponents of freedom of speech as long as they were the minority. But now that they're gaining control of the institutions, now you see all kinds of restrictions on speech being proposed. And deplatforming is the sort of the name that they use to stop people from speaking who they think should not be allowed to speak.
Well, look, where do you come down on that? Because things like Facebook obviously is a private company. Google is a quasi-private. I mean, you can argue about DARPA getting involved in algorithm or whatever. Where do you come down on now this private corporation can totally wipe somebody out digitally? Where do you come down on that issue?
I think it's a very interesting and difficult problem because, yes, I acknowledge what people like Senator Josh Hawley and others have argued, that, you know, private companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter have a greater power to stop us from being heard than the government does in operation because so many people want to use those platforms. On the other hand, let me just say, I have yet to hear a proposal for how that can be addressed by the government that would not therefore be turned against us. That is, I live through the Fairness Doctrine. That was the government trying to impose a balance requirement on radio and television, government-controlled radio and television. As a result of that, conservatives did not have any platform at all. I'm old enough to remember when conservatives had no platform at all on radio and television. It was only with the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine during the Reagan administration that talk radio took off, and that's when we started to have a genuine argument in this country, a debate in this country between left and right in the media. So I have not seen a proposal yet which would go after Twitter, Facebook, or Google that would not empower an agency or unit or theory that would then be, once the political tide turns, and the political tide always turns, would not be then used against us.
I don't know where I go down on this. And kind of you kind of are puzzled maybe like I am, but Twitter or Facebook especially, Google is not a private corporation acting on its own. I mean, it is a public forum now. It even gets antitrust protection and all those things, exemptions, because of their ability to basically just, they're not a publisher, they're just a billboard, basically. So they are getting
let me say that, you know, there's no reason why these institutions could not be subjected to the antitrust laws if, in fact, they are violating the antitrust laws. What you have in with a special protection that these mediums have is that they cannot be sued for the statements that are made by people who are on their platform. So that you cannot sue Facebook because somebody posts something on Facebook that you find defamatory. That is the immunity that they have. But that is something that I think you want. I think that's the kind of immunity you want somebody.
Do
like
you
that
want
to
them
have
to have? Yes.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, my friend Glenn Reynolds at Instapundit, who's a University of Tennessee law professor, has a book about this, in which he argues that antitrust laws should be used. If these guys have monopolies, then use antitrust laws to break them up. That's what they're for. That's what antitrust laws are for. But that's not the same thing as either subjecting them to liability for speech that occurs on their platform or regulating the kinds of speech that they can engage in. Glenn's against doing that. I, again, say I understand why this is a problem, but I don't see any solution that isn't worse than the disease.
That's interesting. We're going to leave that at that argument at that, and I'm sure the debate will go on because it's, you know, that's our digital self is almost more important than our regular self now, for better or for worse. Fourth Amendment, you mentioned unreasonable searches, the original intent. That seems to me the Fourth Amendment is the government almost ignores it at this point. Let's talk about original intent. What did the founders mean, and how would they look at what is typical operations by police now and law enforcement and government now?
Well, it's a little difficult for us to reconstruct the world that the founders had, the legal world that the founders had, because in their world, there were no police departments like we have. There were no official police departments. There were constables, there were magistrates, but there were basically the community enforced their own rules through the hue and cry and other devices. So if a government official were to come, but they did have government officials who would, you know, violate your rights to person, papers, houses, and effects. They had those. That's why we got the Fourth Amendment. And if they came and they were, they would just be treated that you could sue them for trespass. There was no immunity. They had no immunity from suit for trespass. So in order to get some version of immunity, they basically would get a warrant. And the warrant would be them going to a judge before they came in and said, we have good cause to come in. And so a warrant would immunize them from suit because it would be a prejudgment that they had been acting properly. And that's one reason why the British used warrants, but they used general warrants, which were basically saying we can search anywhere. And the Fourth Amendment was there specifically to prevent the use of general warrants and requiring that the warrant you get, that would be specific to, you know, who was going to be searched and what was going to be searched and what we were going to look for. And so it had specificity is the requirement of a warrant. So you have a warrant requirement. What the Fourth Amendment requires is a specific warrant. But the function that a warrant served was to immunize law enforcement. Nowadays, we have government police agencies that have governmental immunities that were given to them by the courts primarily. And as a result of that, you can't sue them. So the only thing that can happen is you can argue that if they violated your rights, they can suppress evidence. You can suppress evidence they find against you. But that assumes that you're actually guilty of something. They can violate your rights. And if they don't find anything against you, then there's nothing to suppress. So right now, our system is kind of upside down of the kind of system that we had at the time of the founding.
What's your, you know, you mentioned police. Well, sheriffs are constables. That's constitutional. Sheriff of Nottingham all the way back to your English law. That's common law.
Yeah.
What's your feeling on this? Police are unelected. Sheriffs are elected. What's your feeling of that dynamic?
I don't have a general view of this, so you'd probably have to be more specific. I'm a former criminal prosecutor in Chicago. I got along very well with the police. I'm very grateful for the police doing their job. On the other hand, they're government officials like anyone else, and there's lazy ones and there's bad ones as well, alongside very conscientious ones and good ones. I mean, so.
All right, let me ask it this way.
Policing is a complicated subject.
Let me ask it this way. The highest law authority in a county is the sheriff because constitutionally they're the one that's elected. Would you agree with that?
Actually, there are usually many county officers. When I was Cook County State's Attorney, I worked for the Cook County State's Attorney, and he was elected too, along with the sheriff. So,
or law enforcement. I should say law enforcement.
Why don't we get to? I think we're probably going to be running out of time, so I'm not sure we want to go down this rabbit
hole. All right, good. Let's move on. Where do you want to go in the last few minutes? What do you think the most important thing we discuss? We got about 7-8 minutes.
Well, you wanted to talk about the courts, I think. So I think
yes.
one of the things that we could talk about is how I think it's very important for people who believe in the Constitution not to get overly discouraged and depressed and demoralized and think that we're, you know, all is lost and that we cannot do any, we, you know, we can't do anything about this. I agree that, you know, the Constitution is under threat. It's not, it's been under threat for a very long time. This is nothing really new. There are certain things that are new in our current politics, but that's not one of them. And we actually have reasons for feeling like things, some things are going our way. In particular, the courts are going our way. So federal courts, because of the election of 2016, I mean, I should say, leading up to the election of 2016, we had 8 years of federal judicial nominations made by a Democratic president, all by all of people who were generally of the view that the Constitution was a living document and not one that was fixed at the time that it was made. And ever since 2016, we've had a president who's nominated judges who don't have that view. And as a result, whereas if that election had gone the other way and we'd have had 8 more years of judicial appointments, I would think the federal courts would have been lost and lost forever. In fact, I was thinking about leaving constitutional law because of that. Wouldn't have been any point to what I was doing. But with the election of 2016, things are not lost forever. We have dozens and dozens of judges who are constitutionalists being put on the bench. Now, that's not a savior. You can't rely on the courts to save us. This, I told you earlier that we have the right to keep and bear arms because of political action, not because of the courts. That's why we have our. That's why we enjoy a right to keep and bear arms. That, we got to keep that in mind. But on the other hand, things are not all bleak. And if Donald Trump were to get a second term of office, I would expect his judicial nominations to continue. But even if he were to lose, all would not be lost because we will have put on the courts dozens and dozens of judges who are committed to the Constitution, and we can wait until another election. Whereas if we'd have lost 2016, I'm not sure any other election would have mattered.
Wow. That was a very powerful, provocative statement you just made. Let me ask you, since we're staring at this virus and we're seeing quarantines in other countries like Italy, constitutionally, what can the government do against the people when it comes to some emergency like this, the virus situation?
There is no question that there's more question about the powers of the federal government, but there's no question that states have what's called a police power. And the police power includes, among other things, it obviously includes the power to protect our rights by passing laws against murder, rape, armed robbery. Those are the laws that I went to law school to enforce when I became a prosecutor in Chicago, but also to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people. And so health and safety laws are an important part of the police power of states that go all the way back to the beginning. And so there really is no doubt that the states do have the power to do that. As long as they exercise those powers in a way that is justified, and that would be justified on the basis of the facts. And I don't think that in the face of a genuine pandemic, there'd be much doubt that that local authorities do have the police, that the states do have the police power to quarantine individuals who pose a threat to the rights of others, because that is the first duty of government, to protect the pre-existing rights of we the people in our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that means protecting us from our fellow citizens who might be wittingly or unwittingly jeopardizing our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
So a situation where, hey, there's an outbreak in Missouri or whatever state, and then you're going to regionally, the state declares emergency and quarantine certain segments. That would be perfectly constitutional and lawful and right situation.
If those policies were not overbroad, if they were not motivated, let's say, by animus towards particular groups or individuals, but were in fact a product of reasoned public health concerns, yes, they would be constitutional.
Okay. Then let me ask you, some people are concerned, especially the medical freedom area, they're concerned, hey, they're going to come out with some vaccine and they're going to try to force you to have a vaccine. That's another thing. What's your feeling there constitutionally? To force you to take something into your body?
Well, actually, historically, this is complicated because vaccines were upheld or inoculations were upheld. But the laws that were actually upheld were laws that would fine you for failing to get them. In other words, or punish you for failing to get them. They couldn't actually put the needle in your arm, but they could actually punish you for not, if you decided you didn't want to do it yourself. There's a difference between those two things.
Right.
And so actually, in terms of historically, I don't think there's any question actually say today there's no question that such laws would be upheld as constitutional. Historically, they were also upheld as constitutionally under the police power in the way I just said.
I think it's Jacobson versus, is it Jacobson
exactly.
versus Massachusetts,
yeah,
1905,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a big case.
Correct.
Kind of a utilitarian view. We have about a minute and a half.
It's not just utilitarian, because remember, the first duty of government is to protect the rights of us from both the government and from each other. And when any one of us poses a threat to the other, then the government is supposed to step in and protect our rights against our fellow citizens.
Yes, and you said something that's very important, I think, justified on the facts. And so this debate,
yes.
you know, that's when your opinion is getting censored, when facts are getting censored, when this discussion is getting censored, then, you know, what are the facts? What is the truth? So that, you know, you're seeing Facebook and they're even stopping discussion about the virus now. I'm like, what in the world is going on? It's very odd. I don't know. Anyway, I don't want to end there. This has been a fantastic interview. Randy, very appreciative of you coming on. Your new book is An Introduction to Constitutional Law. When you buy it, you got access to a lot of other information, 100 Supreme Court cases.
The videos.
Everyone should know you have access to these videos. You have access to so much information. And as you can tell, Randy's extremely sharp, extremely good perspective, and I just very good to have him on. Got about a minute or so. Last thoughts for our listeners.
Well, we spent 2 years making these videos. We spent $100,000 in production costs for the videos, and you'll see myself and my co-author, Josh Blackman, on camera walking you through constitutional law from the founding until today.
Oh, that is fantastic. Stay right there, Randy. Stay right there. I won't say bye to you after. Ladies and gentlemen, okay. We want you happy, healthy, successful, and free as God intends you to be. It's all in your hands. And we have dominion, and we have opportunity, and we have a founding fathers to go on. What will our future be? Let's shape it in law, will we? Yes. God bless you. See you tomorrow. Thanks, Todd.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.